Someone's got to do it. While leading a headquarters company can bring a unique set of challenges, it can also be extremely rewarding. Known frequently as this being a second-in-command opportunity, commanding a HHC requires a different kind of leadership than a line company would require. This is the Leaders Huddle Podcast, Episode 32, Leading a HHC Company, Challenges and Techniques. Welcome to the Leaders Huddle Podcast. Through this podcast, our goal is to educate and inspire the current generation of company-grade officers through advancing the discussion of leadership, professionalism, and building high-performing organizations. I am your host for today's episode, Captain Micah Klein. With me today, co-hosting this episode, is Captain David Wirt. Before we get started, let's introduce our guest, Captain Nate Wyke. Nate Shinvia, ROTC, and commissioned as a Field Artillery 2nd Lieutenant. He has deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and he commanded HHC 210th BSB, Brigade Support Battalion, followed by Foxtrot Company 210 Brigade Support Battalion at Fort Drum, New York. He's married with three children and is currently serving as a strategic planner at U.S. Army Forces Command at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Nate, if there's anything about your bio that we forgot, please go ahead and feel free to include it.
No, you gentlemen pretty much hit the high points. Happy to be on the show.
Awesome. All right, so let's get this kicked off. So, Nate, I vividly remember wrapping up my first company command, and I was waiting on an RFO from HRC for my broadening assignment. And after waiting for about 2 weeks with no word, I remember my brigade commander told me that I'd be starting inventories on Monday if nothing came from West Point. So, thankfully, the RFO ended up coming later that day. How did you get selected for the HHC command? And what were some of your initial thoughts when you found out you'd be commanding an HHC?
Well, first, I have to say I sort of take a certain unique bit of pride in the fact that I feel I haven't had a very quote-unquote standard career. So just a microcosm of that is the headquarters company. It was actually my first command. And like you said from my bio, I was a combat arms officer, I was a field artilleryman. And it was the headquarters company for the Brigade Support Battalion, which, as you can probably imagine, was somewhat outside of my comfort zone. At that time, I was an assistant S3 for the Field Artillery Battalion, and the brigade I was in, 210, was in the process of converting to a Security Force Assistance Battalion, or SFAB, prior to its deployment to Afghanistan. And that's an important detail for context, because anyone who's been in a brigade that's converting to an SFAB knows that you have a lot of officers, company grade and field grade, who begin to show up and who nominally are entitled to a position in the command queue. So if you only have, you know, so many commands available and you've got an excess of officers arriving, you can imagine that that creates a certain pressure on the system, especially when you have officers who are only on station for 3 to 4 years and have to get their key development time out of the way. But as we were converting to an SFAB, I was midway in Fort Polk, Louisiana, in support of that when I got a message from my battalion commander at the time asking if I would accept a command if one were immediately available. And I didn't accept, you know, right away. I think, you know, to my credit in hindsight, I asked him for some time. I called my wife and discussed it with her. And we thought that at the time it made sense. You mentioned your broadening assignment, Micah. That's something we were looking at really seriously. We knew we could have a broadening assignment if we got our command time, our KD time taken care of. And ultimately I said yes. And at the time, frankly, and speaking for the benefit of hindsight, I'm not sure, you know, what I thought. I thought it was good for my career, but frankly, I didn't really understand the magnitude of the task that I was accepting. I knew that commanding a headquarters first was not considered to be ideal. However, you know, I thought it would be a unique and professionally rewarding challenge, and it supported what I thought my career ambitions were at the time, and it was a good way to support my brigade commander and helping him get his command queue straightened out.
Very cool. Thanks for sharing that. That's definitely a unique path for sure. So I have a follow-up question. I wanted to touch on, and I remember when I was offered my first company command, and I remember being told never turn down the opportunity to command, which I think is for the most part true. However, I think that there is an aspect to leading an organization and commanding a company and being, you know, having a career in the military where you've got to do to a certain degree what you would like to do. And so I was offered my first company command at Fort Campbell, and I actually turned that down after talking to my wife, fiance at the time, because it just didn't meet sort of our family and future goals. So you mentioned that you consulted with your family before you took the command. What advice would you offer anyone who's listening here who is perhaps in a command queue or looking at taking company command when it comes to consulting family before taking such an important opportunity?
Well, I mean, really, I think anyone who is married, and especially one who's married and has children, you know, you simply cannot separate that aspect of your life from your career. I mean, they share it with you. And in my opinion, they're entitled to a say in your career choices. Now, it might not be the last say. Like, you know, my wife does not peruse the regulation for commissioned officer development on a regular basis. But everything that I do has an effect on her and our children. And my best advice is whoever your spouse is involve them in the decision making.
All right. That's cool. That's pretty straightforward. I appreciate that. I'm going to pass the mic off to David. He's going to fire away at the second question.
So Nate, at most every change of command for HHC or an FSC, we often hear that HHC or FSC is its own unique beast. Is this really true or is that overblown? And how was commanding the HHC different from your other command?
I'm not sure that I would say it is untrue. I wouldn't say that it's overblown. But, you know, frankly, I think that every command is its own unique beast. So especially for a first-time commander is that, you know, you just don't know what you're getting into. And it's a great experience, you know, especially looking back. But every command comes with their own challenges. And a lot of those challenges, they come from, you know, the diverse groups of men and women who are soldiers in the U.S. Army. And then, of course, you know, the unpredictable situations that are just an accepted part of our careers. So no two commands are the same. You could have for example, a great chain of command and never deploy, or you can have a deployment that has like adds a lot of stress to your command. I mean, engineers are going to be different than a chemical company, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I will say, you know, having, you know, somewhat ironically, given my answer to question one, had a opportunity to command again, I certainly understand in hindsight the shock that occurs, you know, as one transitions, you know, in the opposite direction of what I did, because like I said, I went from headquarters to sort of a line forward support company. I understand the system shock that probably occurs when you go from a line, company, battery, or troop all of a sudden to a headquarters command. Just the fact of the matter is that you suddenly have, you know, a lot fewer soldiers and they're not necessarily beholden to you. You have a significant amount of property and then a whole array of challenges, you know, that where the simplest of tasks are often the most complicated to accomplish.
So Nate, as an engineer, I actually commanded an FSC in an engineer battalion, and you know, as naturally I wanted a line or a sapper or construction company, and made those intentions clear to my battalion commander even when one of the horizontal construction companies came back open open in the queue. And he looked me straight in the eye and said, "David, I hear you, but I need you to FSC because the whole battalion suffers if we don't get FSC and HHC right." And so that kind of gave me a confidence booster that he was giving me a unique challenge. I'm curious to hear what your battalion or brigade commander, what they gave you as guidance or advice, if any, prior to taking HHC.
Well, that is a good question. I mean, they definitely gave me the stock advice. I mean, and I don't mean that to belittle it, because it's stock advice, you know, because it's true, is that if you don't get those logistics and headquarters elements right, then the whole organization is going to suffer. I think it's a unique point of pride, and no one actually, you know, ever said this to me, or I doubt they say it to anybody. When they offer those second commands, or in my case, you know, this first command, like, they're giving you a vote of confidence, and that they're giving you something that if you get it right, even though it is very difficult, then, you know, the whole organization will benefit. And if you get it wrong, it's not that there's not really any danger or repercussions, but the damages can be mitigated because of the way the HHC is. The seniors in the company will be able to reach down and maybe exert more control than they otherwise would. But yeah, I think having an HHC, it's a good thing to have in your resume as a young officer.
So one last follow-up. I'm curious, like, I, as an FSC commander, I learned a lot about multifunctional logistics as an engineer, and I use that knowledge to really teach and train my dads who don't get taught a lot about logistics. If you could wrap up some, like, hard or and just career lessons you learned as an HHC commander for our listeners, what are some of those big Army type lessons that you learned as an HHC commander?
Well, for myself personally, it was really eye-opening, because I essentially went cold from being a combat arms-oriented officer all of a sudden to the headquarters commander of the brigade support battalion. So there is definitely a opportunity for professional growth for me. It is a nice way to put it. I'll say it was actually, you know, pretty difficult in the early days trying to align my thinking with that of my soldiers, and then with the officers and NCOs that I was responsible for. So in the end, you know, at the time it was very frustrating, but in the end, you know, I think it was good for me, because it helped me to learn to see outside of myself and to look at the bigger picture, and to understand that even as a combat arms officer with no experience in this, as long as I apply myself to the task, as learn as much as I can, and work with those around me, then I could be successful, and then the organization could still be successful.
Awesome. So moving on to our third question here, what was different from a property UCMJ maintenance or training perspective, and what were the administrative aspects of, and were the HHC administrative aspects easier or harder for you, do you think?
Well, I was fortunate in this aspect, in that when I was the HHC commander, I spent the majority of my time either deployed or preparing to deploy or just coming back from a deployment. So I really didn't have up front the UCMJ and maintenance issues that my counterpart experienced back in the rear, which, you know, is this whole other story, which we all know about, you know, the rear detachment. So while I was deployed, I really didn't have to deal with that sort of thing. Now, from a training and administrative perspective and a property perspective, I had a pretty heavy task, and I don't think anyone will be surprised to hear about it. Just for example, even while deployed, I had a 33-page property book. And so most of that was TPE, or theater-provided equipment, and I took great pleasure as we closed the FOB we were on and seeing that property book gradually shrink and shrink and shrink. And it aligned with my goal to redeploy and not owe the government any money to make sure all of that property was well taken care of. But training-wise and administration-wise, yeah, the typical challenge with the HHC is that your job is to enable the staff to function while also ensuring the staff is trained and up to date on all the critical requirements. And sometimes those two missions, they come into conflict, and it's difficult sometimes, you know, to go into a room full of majors and your peers who are captains and senior NCOs and tell them that they gotta vacate the office and they gotta get out to the range. At the same time, like whenever any disciplinary issues or counselings with soldiers did come up, at times there could be some friction with that soldier's OIC, who would be a captain or a major, who felt that it wasn't, or it was, who felt it was their place to essentially exercise discipline and whatnot that was really the purview of the company commander. So this is how I dealt with those things. You know, I would say it's important to just be flexible and to build relationships and to utilize your support chain that is there for every commander.
How did you, I guess, divvy up or create shares of the task between you and your first sergeant? Was there, I mean, obviously there are typical things that a first sergeant would handle that a company commander would, wouldn't handle, but were there any unique things or things that were different? How did you and your first sergeant tackle those issues?
Well, first, I think it was important. He and I agreed at the beginning, it was important to show presence. So we would make it a point in the morning or in the evening while we're deployed, go together and just walk through the talk and the different buildings that comprise the battalion area, just checking in with each section. And what I said in my previous question, just building those relationships. So he, you know, I would say he focused on the NCOs, so those section NCOs, and trying to talk to them about, hey, this is the company's intent, here's what we're trying to do with, you know, X, Y, or Z initiative. At the same time, you know, I would be applying the same message to the staff officers, just trying to get everyone on the same sheet of music and everybody working towards the same end state. So it, I don't want to say it was a divide and conquer. I mean, we had a unified effort, and we knew it was important to get buy-in from our those who were in our company, as opposed to trying to work against them.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Sort of a follow-up to that, there's always the possibility for young lieutenants coming out of Bolick that they're going to get assigned to an HHC. How did you employ your lieutenants, and what was their job in your organization?
The lieutenants in my organization, at least in the unique structure for the headquarters for the Brigade Support Battalion, is that the company headquarters itself is very small. So I really wasn't directly responsible for a lot of young officers, new lieutenants and whatnot. They almost, you know, invariably went to one of the staff sections while they're waiting for a platoon leader position to open up. Now, with that, that didn't mean they were, immune from any additional duties that may come up. So I had the opportunity to spend time with a good many lieutenants who either they were an investigating officer for something, or they were, say, for example, like a UMO. So I should probably include warrant officers in there. So we had the opportunity to work together and to work various problems. And hopefully I was able to provide some decent mentorship, and they were able to see, you know, the challenges that we deal with the headquarters, and just where they were able to pitch in and help and find value in that.
So, Nate, you alluded to it earlier. Part of commanding an HHHC means negotiating the challenge of leading and commanding the headquarters staff with at least two field grades, the battalion command commander and the sergeant major. And I remember my battalion commander, my last battalion, routinely saying, hey, I'm still on the HHC's 162, and the HHC commander still has to certify my family care plan. So I wanted to kind of dive into that unique relationship where you have multiple senior NCOs, officers, and sometimes difficult, that can be difficult, warrant officers. What advice can you offer to our listeners as far as not only commanding, but also leading that unique group?
I think it's important first for that HHC commander to remember that, you know, they are the commander. You mentioned the 162, you know, the company commander is the one who signs that. They have their authority from AR-600-20, and no other captain, no other officer in that company has that same authority. And they have, you know, their rating chain is a battalion commander followed by the brigade commander. So I think it's important for that officer just to remember that, not to throw it into anyone's face, because, you know, that would end out poorly if, you know, they tried to, you know, bow up on people and try and wrap themselves in some blanket of authority. But it's important just to remember that they're responsible for what all the company does or fails to do. And they also have a unique relationship with the command team, to include the XO and the S3. They can reach back to those men and women who have all most likely commanded headquarters themselves, and they can seek their advice and get their support for various things. So the field grades and sergeant major especially, they know the unique challenges that the headquarters is going through. And in my experience, at least, they are more than willing to help. But again, so long as any initiatives that you come up with, you know, don't conflict with the main mission, which is keeping the organization running. And I should probably include in there also, don't forget, you know, the family readiness group, to include the spouse of the commander and command sergeant major. Significant support network that you've got to stay dialed in with, and so that you are taking a holistic approach to supporting the entire company. Because I don't think you don't want to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, my company is made up of all these senior individuals, so it's going to take care of itself and you're going to get involved with the family readiness group, or you mentioned family care plans or whatnot. So, I mean, that'd be the wrong answer. It's your job to make sure that stuff taken care of. I've said it several times. The second thing is making sure the battalion staff and the headquarters functions. And I think the best way to do that, you know, is to look at your headquarters medal, actually get onto the online system. In my day, which wasn't that long ago, it was CATS. I'm not sure what it is now, but get on there and you can actually look up, you know, what your doctrine mission essential task list is for a headquarters. And I think study that and know what it is. And I hate to say it, it comes as a realization, I think, to people who have a headquarters or second command, a lot of the things that made them successful in their first command won't show up on that core medal for a headquarters. An example I like to use is, you know, conduct company live fire, or even a squad live fire. I didn't see that on my medal for a headquarters. But unfortunately, for a lot of combat arms-oriented officers, that's a big point of success for them, is to carry something like that out when they're a line company commander. But the two, they simply just don't go together, because a task like that, it doesn't apply to the staff. It doesn't help the staff run better. And it's just realizing that keeping your company green in MedPros, for example, everyone's up to date on marksmanship, all the PT tests are current. You know, those are really simple tasks. They're difficult to accomplish, but if you can accomplish them, then that is a very big feather in your cap. It's an achievement for you as a commander. The way you get after those things, or at least the way I tried to get after them, was just having good processes in place for managing personnel and accounting for property. So the way I was able to do that was making sure I had concise, reasonable policy letters that were backed up by doctrine or higher level policy letters. And I made sure to really use the counseling system. So my hand receipt holders were a good example. I guess rather selfishly didn't want to leave command owing the government any money. So I made sure every month, before I signed my property book, I would always, always have a hand receipt holder counseling and ensure that they signed their sub hand receipts. And I use that as a venue to also convey my intent, to talk about training and whatnot, because those hander seat holders usually were the section NCOs or the, in some cases, the OICs. And we use that as a venue to establish a common ground. And then the last piece of advice I would say is, you know, be flexible and be prepared to compromise. So I mentioned PT test as an example, where in a line company, you may be able to have like 2 days in a row where you can do nothing but the PT test and get your entire company taken care of. Well, I mean, for the headquarters, you most likely might not be able to do that. I found that success was scheduling a PT test for the same day of the week, 3 weeks in a row was one technique. And that enabled everyone to know in advance, hey, this is when the test day is. I can't make an appointment or whatnot. I was able to square it with the battalion XO so that, you know, no one could play a mommy daddy game and say the XO gave me this task. And that was because people knew in advance and they had predictability. I think it's important with that also, with speaking of the flexibility and compromise, is that you just don't want to come off too strongly to the point where you start to burn bridges. And because then you'll start to be marginalized by the staff, who will just do everything they can, I think, to try and get out of whatever it is that you want to do if you don't try and meet them halfway. And also with that, you know, that's an important point of advocating, you know, for the soldiers that you do have and everyone that is in the company, because like we have already talked about, those soldiers, no matter what their rank is, they're on your 162. You're responsible for them and managing their time and making sure that they're well taken care of.
Man, Nate, you really jumped into some essential basics that Mike and I here are just sitting here shaking our heads, and it is still actually CATS. That's where every lieutenant or future commander can find the missed essential task list for their unit by MTO. And as I'm listening, I'm trying to think of my previous HHC commanders, those that were successful and those that really struggled. And those that were successful were incredibly good at interpersonal tact and building, not burning bridges, specifically with the S3 and XO, and spending time with them and having office calls to ensure that both the intent of the HHC commander when it came to 600-20 and 350-1 type tasks and policies were met, while also supporting the staff training and almost like merging those two training calendars. And it's a constant evolving battle that as long as you're on the same page, you can remain flexible, as you mentioned.
All right, so moving on to the next question, which is a little bit off topic, but soon after you relinquished command, you made a jump from the combat arms branch of FA to FA 59, which is Army Strategist for all of those folks who may not have heard of that. How did your experience serving as an HHC commander prepare you for such a technical functional area?
Well, that's actually a really good question, because I really wasn't prepared for it at first, but having considered it, I found a lot of actually correlation between commanding a headquarters and then in my functional area being a strategic planner. So yeah, like you said, once I was done with headquarters, I had a stint where I had a second command, which was very unexpected. We talked about at the beginning, like I thought I'd get my KD time from the HHC and move on. Instead, I had a second command. And then after that, I transferred over to be a strategist. So a lot of people don't know what the strategists do, but in a nutshell, like we work on high level staves. I'm talking a division. There's a few strategists there, but definitely core and above. A lot of opportunities for a strategist to serve. And with that comes a lot of interaction at with different headquarters, with a lot of senior individuals, to include general officers. And though, I mean, the HHC, I didn't have any general officers in my HHC. I think the experience helped me to do what we talked about, was to form relationships and to influence and in some cases, you know, lead organizations and individuals who, you know, may outrank me or may have a different opinion or different approach to a problem that I'm not supposed to be in charge of. And just, it gave me the tools, I think, to help and bridge those gaps and keep everyone working towards the same desired end state.
Nate, we're wrapping up here with the last question. So the HEC, as we mentioned before, it Command is Command. It is unique. What books or resources would you recommend that our listeners can check out before they take the guide on for an HEC?
So I'm going to just revert back to some of the doctrinal answers, mostly just because I think a lot of people, you know, they don't give enough credence to the doctrine that already exists. First, I'll make a plug for Taking the Guide On. I definitely read that. I read it a couple times before I took command. And I think the lessons that are in that book are very useful and applicable. I recommend that to anybody. Definitely, I think there is one book or manual that every officer should read that, you know, I think it's sort of like Clausewitz. It's, you know, the most quoted, least read bit of Army doctrine is AR 600-20, cover to cover, I think is something that a young officer, one who's pre-command or even just getting to command, needs to pick up, because that lays out, you know, what your authorities are as the commander and the basis from which you should conduct yourself. And then going with that, I already talked about, you know, my example was I didn't want to owe any money due to a financial investigation because of property. So I made sure I was current on the relevant doctrinal publications for property management. So that was AR 735-5. And then another example we used was a PT test, how often you can have them, under what conditions, et cetera. So AR 21-20 gave us, you know, the foundation for setting those events. If nothing else, it gave us the cover to say we are following everything according to the letter of the law. And, you know, barring any extenuating circumstances, you know, officers, senior NCOs, everyone in the company has no reason not to comply. And then we already talked about the MTO and the medal, knowing those things in advance. And then if you're probably sitting in an HAC waiting for your command to open up, you know, keeping your fingers crossed, hoping it's not the HAC. But regardless, there's nothing to stop the command from reading the posted policy letters and then working on their own and sort of shaping their command time in advance. So using those things as a resource is a great starting point. And then also talking to the field grade officers who have been there and then the other commanders who are currently living it and just leaning forward and planning out your own command time, I mean, will pay enormous dividends in the future.
We'll be sure to include all of those references in our show notes. And to remind our listeners, we actually interviewed the authors of Taking the Guide On back on episodes 24 and 25. And Leaders Huddle contributor Josh Bowen has a good blog series on command. And one of them is the importance of good policy letters. You know, it's not the most exciting thing. It's not necessarily what will get on your OER, get you promoted, but they're incredibly important for establishing a healthy command climate. And Nate, I'm going to add one book that's not listed in any Army reference that I think could be applicable specifically for those officers that have HHC as their second command. And it's a book by Marshall Goldsmith titled What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And specifically, it goes over the 20 habits that you need to stop doing to be successful at the next level. And if you're looking at HHC as another level of command and promoting some self-awareness, I think that book and Goldsmith's work may help on the coaching and development of leaders as they progress.
Yeah, definitely. I'd check that out myself. I wanted to say I thought of one more thing that was useful to me, though it was dated at the time I picked it up, was an officer named Joe Byerly has one, the Commander's First Sergeant Guide. which I found to be very useful. It's something that he, when he was a company commander, him and his first sergeant threw together, and basically they just went through and they sort of broke down their command of, these are the numbers I had to call or I had to have on speed dial. These are my daily and weekly events and whatnot. And I thought that was a good guide as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. We're actually going to go ahead and wrap this episode up. So we want to thank you for coming on today. This wraps up today's Leaders Huddle podcast. In the next episode, David and I will be sitting down to discuss Leaders Huddle 1 year later, what we've learned along the way from our journey to idea and reality. You can tweet directly to us by using the handle @leaders_huddle and check out our Facebook at our new Leaders Huddle page. You can find all of our episodes on iTunes and the Google Play podcast channel. We want to hear from you, our listeners, on the topics you would like us to discuss. So please leave a comment on iTunes in the form of a rating and review. Until next time, get out there and make a difference in your organization. This is the Leaders Huddle podcast, signing off.
The views expressed in the Leaders Huddle podcast are the opinions of the hosts and guests. The discussion shared here does not represent the official position of the United States Military Academy or the U.S. Army.